Welcome to Retro Sports Rewind, a podcast where we look back at some of the greatest games in sports history. We rewatch these classics, give you the history behind the matchup, run through the highlights, and discuss what made the game so great. Before we begin, we invite you to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And we also ask that you please rate and review the show. We love those five-star ratings. They go a long way in sharing the show with others. I'm Zach Wilt. I'm joined by my good pals and co-hosts. First up, it's Jabby Burns. How are you, Jab?
Oh, Zach, it's so good. It's like getting into like a warm bath. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but I love it because hanging out with you, that's a first take. I mean, you just came in, right? Super hot. Haven't done this in over a year, probably. Had a lot of stuff going on in your life. All of us have had all kinds of stuff going on. But holy cow, is this fun, Zach. I'm so happy to be here. Great idea on your part, especially with everything going on. A lot of binging, a lot of watching, and we were watching some games, Zach, and I just can't believe that we're back together, brother.
I know. It's going to be so fun. And to welcome Patrick Guthrie to the warm bath as well. How are you, Patrick?
That was not a sentence I was expecting to hear, but I'm happy to hear it. Like kind of what Jab just said, we've all had so much stuff going on, and now we really don't have a lot going on. None of us. I mean, we're all doing something, but we're all home a lot. So we're available to do this, and it's awesome. And we're going to look at all these great games, and I think we're starting at the best possible place, which is the place that, you know, we usually go to when we podcast, which is baseball. And honestly, one of my favorite non-Mets baseball games I've ever watched. So I'm very excited to do this.
This is going to be fun. Yeah, the life is a little bit different right now, but we are making the best of it. Social distancing, recording via Skype, kind of like we did when we were within close proximity of each other anyway. But now we're spread throughout, quarantined in our houses for well over a month, and bringing you this project, which I'm super excited about. So this is our pilot episode. It's a project that we've been discussing as quarantined sports fans without anything new to watch. There's a ton of great games in history that we witnessed or heard about, and now really seemed like a perfect time to relive them all with you. So every game that we talk about on the podcast is available in some form or fashion on YouTube. And we've done our homework by reliving them all. So in our show notes, you can find a link to the games that we discuss. So you too, if you'd like, can go back and rewatch them with us. So Jab, what's in store for this week?
Well, this is great because there's so many memories I have from this game, but it's the 2001 World Series. November 4th, by the way, with one of the latest starts, I think the latest start ever in baseball, when you'll figure out why this happened. If you just think about 2001 and go back to that for a little bit. We're game 7 between the Yankees and D-backs, the Snakes, out there in the desert. And I'm telling you, it was an amazing, amazing game, and I can't wait to start talking about it, Zach.
Yeah, this is an all-time classic and really seemed like the perfect place for us to start with this podcast. One that we probably didn't have to rewatch, but we did our homework anyway. So, Patrick, why don't you set us up and take us back?
Okay. Very selfishly, off the top of this, very quickly, this 2001, from a purely sports perspective, was the absolute peak of my Yankees hate. Because the Yankees, and it's almost impossible to fathom at this point exactly how dominant the Yankees were going into this World Series. They'd won the last three. They'd won the last three easily. They beat the Mets. Oh, God. They beat the Mets in the Subway Series 4-1 in 2000, and they swept the previous two by a combined essentially 8-0. And even before that, they didn't win in 97, but they won in 96. So they'd won of four of the previous five World Series, which is a crazy statement to say. And then the previous three before that. So they were a dynasty. They were everybody kind of debates, you know, were the San Francisco Giants a dynasty? Well, they didn't win every year. The Yankees won every single year. They won 3 years in a row. It was amazing. And they had put together this amazing core of players. And going into this World Series, I mean, they were the better team going in, matching up against the Diamondbacks team that was a bunch of veterans, a bunch of really talented veterans, including one guy, Luis Gonzalez, who had an all-world MVP type of campaign if it wasn't for Barry Bonds, where he hit 57 home runs, kind of like blew past all of his previous career highs. And they obviously had two of the best pitchers I've ever seen on the same team.
Oh, yeah.
Kurt Schilling and Randy Johnson, who were amazing. And this was kind of a back and forth series. I mean, there were some blowout games. There were some good games. Both teams kind of fought through to first round of the playoffs to get here. They both won deciding game fives to get to where they were. And then once we got into this series, it was the Diamondbacks dominating the first two games with Schilling and Johnson out in Arizona. And then once it got back to New York, the Yankees had some unbelievable magical moments that
crazy
against the backdrop of what happened, obviously, with September 11th. This was something that the city really needed. And like I said, from a sports perspective, I really dislike the Yankees, but it was really hard not to be caught up in what they were doing. The three total home runs off Byung-Hyun Kim late in the game.
Crazy.
And as bad as you felt for that guy, it was the loudest I'd ever heard a game on TV when Tino and then Jeter and then Brocious the following night hit those home runs. It felt like this was some magic that the Yankees were, you know, that they were going to come back and do this. Even though for the most part of the series, for the vast majority of the series, the Diamondbacks were the better team.
Yeah.
Indisputably against the Yankees. It was just their bullpen that blew it. Game six was a wash. Randy Johnson came out and essentially just needed to show up because the D-backs just teed off on Andy Pettitte and won 15-2. And that led into a amazing matchup. Honestly, if I look back at it, maybe one of the greatest Game 7 pitching matchups ever in two should-be Hall of Famers of Roger Clemens and Kurt Schilling. In terms of if you're taking everything else off the table for both of those guys outside of baseball, which is a lot. it's a lot. But talent-wise, they're two of the most talented pitchers of the past 30 years. And it's just as a baseball fan, it is a dream matchup between those two guys to see them going toe-to-toe. And that's kind of what was leading into this Game 7. It was still kind of, even after that blowout, I remember thinking that this is the Yankees are going to figure out a way because they always had. There wasn't a world that I knew from like the previous 5 years that the Yankees lost a big game. So I figured they were going to show up and figure this out. But yeah, it was leading into what looked like a phenomenal matchup in Game 7. And Zach, you can feel free to take us away with the game because I feel like that's where we should focus. This game was awesome.
Yeah, the game was amazing, and I love your kind of hot take there on the Hall of Famers, because in researching the game, you look at the Hall of Famers that were in the game, and it's Randy Johnson, Derek Jeter. Well, in the series, I should say, Randy Johnson, Derek Jeter, Mike Mussina, Mariano Rivera, and Joe Torre, and you know that's missing the pitching matchup altogether in Game 7, which, like you said, is two guys that purely by the numbers and talent wise should be there as well. Before we run through the game itself, and I have a bunch of highlights that I want to take us through and get your guys' takes on, you know, it's setting the game itself up. In some ways, when I rewatched this game, it didn't seem like that long ago, and in other ways, it felt like forever ago. And what I mean by that is the quality of the broadcast. And granted, I'm watching on YouTube.
Oh,
just feels like something that,
yeah,
you know, it's like watching clips of like 1970s baseball. The difference between the quality of the game, you know, now and then, and clearly it wasn't that long ago. Looking at little things, Patrick, like the score bug, right? It looks so old just looking at the score bug.
Yep.
But at the same time, we've got Joe Buck and Tim McCarver on the call, and it's like that doesn't seem like it was that long ago when, you know, when those two guys, granted Joe Buck's still going, but, you know, so I had these kind of like mixed feelings about where I was in time watching this game.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's interesting, too. Going back real quick to the pitchers, this past World Series we just had with the Nats, going with Strasburg and Scherzer, basically. And even if you want to throw into this lesser extent, Corbin, what, how many years later? What, 20 years later, 19 years later? It's kind of that same mantra that got the Nats to where they were, too. Not as dominant, maybe, as Randy Johnson and them and Schilling was, but still, like, there's some, you know, interesting things there where, you know, Davey was saying, I don't care, I'm throwing my guys. I mean, Scherzer was getting up a bunch. That's what's cool about this in this series. But you're right when you talk about that, Zach. It is crazy to think that all these different type of broadcasts, and you've been watching these games of late, the broadcasts have gotten better. Even the picture has gotten wider too, right? Like some of the camera shots got a little bit better. Of course, you had all the shots in the stands that year of, you know, the you know, would they have the Bernie Mac show? Yes. They had the Rudy Giuliani's hat. You know, all the emotion. I mean, like Patrick said, it was in a very emotional time, and one of the reasons why this game was pushed back so far was because of September 11th. We also remember Cal Ripken retired that year as well, Zach, and that was also a huge thing just in Baltimore, too.
Yeah, that's a good point, kind of keeping us in perspective as to where we are in time, comparing it to something locally. We're a couple of Orioles fans and a Mets fan, in case you haven't picked that up. It's interesting, Patrick, watching this one, because one of the things I noticed immediately, just in terms of the broadcast, is Jab kind of alluded to the ads throughout the game, right? So we saw an ad for the Bernie Mac show, which feels like forever ago. And sadly, you know, Bernie Mac's not even with us anymore. We were getting these lower thirds with updates from the Emmy Awards. So Bradley Whitford, I did too. I was soaking that up, man. That was great. But Bradley Whitford winning for the West Wing, which, my goodness, like the West Wing being on, that seems like a long time ago. The director for Malcolm in the Middle, whose name I forget, he was a winner during the Emmy Awards. And as I'm watching this, I'm thinking, man, from a TV standpoint, isn't it weird that the Emmy Awards are going on at the same time as Game 7 of the World Series? Like, that's so bizarre. So, you know, a little Googling, and I found out that the Emmys were originally delayed by 9/11. Like, a lot of things were. They were pushed back by 9/11. And then they were rescheduled, and they were pushed back again when we declared war on Afghanistan. And they ended up being scheduled the same night as this game, which, as Jab mentioned, is the latest in a year that a World Series game had ever been played. So really watching this game kind of takes you back to 2001, seeing the American flags in the stands and on the uniforms, the shots of Rudy Giuliani and the crowd with his FDNY PD hat, just tons of emotion. I really liked the national anthem and God Bless America. I'm going to have to look up the guy's name, but it was not sung. It was played by somebody on the trumpet, which I thought for some reason just added this kind of strange emotional touch to the whole thing. I don't know, but it really, all of those things in this broadcast, Patrick, really kind of brought me back to that time.
When you mentioned the thing with the Emmys, it kind of is relevant to what we're going through today, in that, like, we're going to have stuff like the Masters being played in November. And all of these sporting events and all of these things that are supposed to be happening now are going to get pushed back. And we're going to have something not definitively like the Emmys being played during Game 7 of the World Series. But if the World Series does get played, it'll be, you know, played in November, December, whenever it's going to be played. And we're going to have a situation or a couple situations in the calendar later in the year where things that are usually spaced out by months are happening at the same time. And it's a wild thing to see, like you said, and something we totally glossed over, or I totally glossed over, the George Bush first pitch.
Yes.
Which was one of the great, I mean, again, taking your entire opinions of the guy's presidency out of everything, which is, again, very difficult to do, kind of like it was with Schilling and Roger Clemens. Right. Maybe the greatest first pitch in the history of baseball.
Yep.
Absolutely dead center strike. And I mean, it was
a little heat, too.
Such a huge moment. And there's obviously that great story about how he was warming up underneath the stadium and Jeter was with him. And I think Jeter said, I think Bush asked him for advice and Jeter said, "Don't bounce it, they'll boo you."
Yeah.
But a couple things about that, too, from the rubber, which, respect, man, respect.
Yeah. Yep.
And wearing a bulletproof vest. Like, I mean, that, again, like you said, I feel like we need to preface this with whatever your political opinions are. We'll throw those out the window. My goodness, I can't think of a first pitch jab that was bigger, was more memorable, was better than this one.
No, I would say Baba Booey's was pretty bad. or 50 Cent's when he did theirs. Maybe they should have watched some tape of good old boy George. The good thing, you know, the cool thing about this whole thing, when baseball side of it, is Bush owned a team too. You know, before he became president, was the owner of the Texas Rangers. So he had some baseball in his blood. And like you said, take your political and take it to the side, especially on this show. He was that guy that you needed at that time and was that guy that really kind of stood up. And to be able to stand up on the rubber right there and fire about a 62-mile-an-hour heater, I don't know. I thought that was fantastic. And it really kind of set the tone for definitely the series.
Well, and it really kind of underscores, you know, we started the show talking about our love for baseball and just the country coming together around baseball, right? And then this was the first a major sports championship since the 9/11 terror attacks, right? And just seeing the country really rally around all of that, it was huge. It was a crazy time. So, all right, we've set it up enough though. Let's dive into the action of what happened in this game. 39-year-old Roger Clemens, who was the oldest starter to ever start a Game 7, was on the mound versus Curt Schilling. And Schilling had already started two games in this series and pitched his 300th inning on just 3 days rest, Patrick. These are our statements that we talked about this game feeling like it's not that long ago. The game has certainly changed since then.
No load management, Patrick.
If you look at, and again, this is... If you look at the 2001 playoffs, that is Curt Schilling's Hall of Fame case. And there's more to it, but Curt Schilling's 2001 playoffs was complete game shutout, complete game one run, seven innings, one run, leading into this game. Unbelievable pitching. And it was, yeah, it was just, like you said, Zach, these guys had rubber arms. I mean, this was a 34-year-old and a 39-year-old, just kind of throwing a billion innings and just keep going out there for more. And they lasted far into this game. It was just great to watch.
They did. Yeah. They, I mean, look at it. Despite the crazy innings totals in the age of these guys, Clemens 6 1/3, 7 hits, an earned run, a walk, and 10 strikeouts. And Jeb Schilling 7 1/3, 6 hits, 2 earned runs, no walks, 9 Ks. Dominance.
Yeah, both guys were on their game. Plus, they, like you said, they had pitched in the series too. So it's not like they were, you know, fresh. And you look at it now too, you know, you think about this 20 years later, or 19 years later, whatever. You're looking at this thing, and now we have starters that come out and start games for an inning, right? And then they come out of the game, and then we go with this bullpen party. And now you go back and look at this, and I'm not the old man with the cane again doing that bit. This was 2001. This was, people were doing this. They shut Strasburg down. He wasn't even injured in 2012, but yet these guys are going out there and doing this, and it does show you, Patrick, you're absolutely right. You know, what, again, take all the things that you think about Schilling aside, he's a Hall of Famer. I don't know how it's not there. Clemens, I don't care if you think he was enhanced or not, whatever you want to think. Guy was 39 years old and was slinging it, was throwing gas down in the zone. I mean, that's the other thing too, guys. They were throwing balls that were, they weren't just blowing guys away. It was the way they were pitching. They were both pitching with just this dominance. And this, both teams were great hitting teams. I mean, the Yankees were known to take you deep into counts, up and down that lineup. Paul O'Neill scares me to this day watching him step to the plate in some of these classic games. Jeter, all the guys, Bernie Williams, you go through it. And then you look at the D-backs on the other side. That lineup, I don't even care. Tony Womack was a beast at the top of that lineup, just trying to keep those things together. Louis Gonzalez, and as you go down that lineup, not a lot of guys that you feel like you could strike out a pretty easy time, but these guys definitely took advantage of that.
You mentioned one guy during the whole lineups that I've got to wonder if it haunts him to this day. Paul O'Neill, in that very first inning, rips a double to the wall and right, and he tries to stretch it to a triple, and he gets thrown out at third. And it's,
great relay.
Listen, a phenomenal relay, great throw by Council, everything, but it's a one-run game. I mean, it's a one-run game, and that could have turned everything if they were able to jump on Schilling a little bit early, if he doesn't get thrown out, if... Who knows? And from there, it's Schilling mode. I mean, Clemens had to work in a couple innings. Like, he had to work deeper into counts. Schilling was 3-4 pitches per batter the whole time. I mean, just through those first couple innings, I remember feeling the same way when Bumgarner pitched against the Mets in the wild card game, where Syndergaard was pitching great, but Bumgarner was getting through innings on 10 pitches. And I felt the same way watching Schilling here. Of just like he was in and out of innings so fast, and it was one of the most impressive pitching performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, definitely. Now, that ended up being a huge moment, and one that I think a lot of people will overlook, you know, without rewatching this game altogether, because really the first 5 innings of this game fly by. because of the dominance of these two starters. And the D-backs finally go up 1-0 in the sixth inning. Danny Bautista breaks the scoreless tie with an RBI double in the bottom of that inning. He scores Steve Finley, and he tries to stretch it out too. Bautista does. He's thrown out at third, but D-backs still go up 1-0. Very aggressive on the base paths jab, and Tim McCarver was loving every second of the aggression from both sides of this.
Well, first of all, Paul O'Neill shouldn't be legging out a triple unless the ball got lost in the corner. So let's start there. I don't know what he's doing. And then other ones, these guys, I think Bautista was thrown out because he was trying to get that run home. And so they had to take advantage, you know, like an infielder's got to figure out, okay, I don't probably got a better shot. I got to get this out. Steve Finley's running. He's got some wheels back in the day, former Oriole, Padre too, I think, but thrown out of third. But these guys were so, and you're right, McCarver loved it. You could tell that they started kind of ramping it up too.
And there's a mic'd up moment with Brenly, and he's talking before the Bautista at bat. I'm assuming he's talking to like the hitting coach or something like that. But right before the at bat, he says, I had the bunt sign on, but I'm going to give him one swing. And sure enough, double to the gap in right center. Like it's one of those things of just like, literally, he just changed his mind at the last second and said, you know what? Danny Bautista has been swinging a hot bat the whole series. Let's give him one shot at Roger Clemens. And what do you know? It pays off.
Yeah. Yeah, sure does. Schilling ended up facing the minimum through six innings, but in the top of the seventh, the Yankees respond. Here's how it happened. Derek Jeter started things off with a single to right field. Paul O'Neill followed that with a bloop to center field. And this was an interesting one, Patrick. Steve Finley's racing up, looking like he's going to try to catch that bloop. He ends up trapping it. Jeter was breaking on contact, and Finley kind of just misses that catch. Really interesting moment there.
Yeah, and especially because Jeter, if he doesn't break on contact, if you notice, and I think obviously since we all watched, you can kind of notice throughout the game, Jeter's limping.
Yep.
Like Jeter is very not healthy in this game. So breaking on contact is kind of a calculated risk of the guy's not working with healthy legs. He's probably taking that. He probably doesn't take that risk if he is healthy, but he knows he needs that extra little bit of time to try and get to where he needs to get to.
Yep. Yep, definitely. So after that, Bernie Williams grounds into a fielder's choice, and that puts runners on first and third with just an out. Tino Martinez is up. He singles to right field, scoring Derek Jeter, tying this game at one. After that, Schilling retires Jorge Posada and Shane Spencer on flyouts to center field to end the inning. And Spencer's was hit deep, Jab. It was hit hard to deep center. Finley on his horse racing it down for the final out of that inning.
How about this? I'm old enough to know Shane Spencer went to a rival high school in San Diego that I went to, Granite Hills High School, same one that Brian Giles went to. They were teammates at one point at Granite Hills. But anyway, so I knew, we all followed him. He was a leaguer. He was one of the kids that we kind of grew up with that was a player. And he had just an awesome, he was having a good series. And I was watching that series, just watching his at-bats, how big he was for them. I have kind of forgot, you kind of forget some of these guys, but he hit a ball really deep in the center field. And I think in a lot of ballparks, especially in Yankee Stadium, where that thing was hit, I think that probably would have been out. But Finley was able to get back there, race it down. Finley was a fantastic outfielder. So, just a great, great defense was great. It was really, really played very tight on both ends from the defense. And I mean that in a good tight way. Like those defensive players were coming up with plays, and it showed how tight this series really was.
And the thing is, if you're our age or like in the general age that we are, people forget how good Steve Finley was. This is a moment that like you see that catch, him racing down that ball in deep center with Shane Spencer. I'm counting them up right now. Six-time Gold Glover throughout his career. And it's you get overshadowed when you're in the National League the majority of your career by Jim Edmonds, who was, like the greatest, one of the greatest defensive center fielders I've ever seen. But Steve Finley was just he's forgotten about so quickly just because there were so many good athletic center fielders back in the 90s or, early 2000s. Steve Finley was a great player, and he had a huge moment on the biggest possible stage. Like that's a game breaker if that ball gets down. And if it's not Steve Finley in center, they probably don't make that out.
Oh, no way. And remember, he 98, he was on the Padres. He was center fielder for the Padres against the Yankees in 98, too. So, I mean, he's been moved around in the NL West. You're right. He was never really thought of as the best center fielder. But if you got to watch him, I watched him a lot because when he was in San Diego, he you know, played him a lot and watched all these games. He was fantastic. The big thing with him, he had wheels, but he got fantastic reads on balls. He took great, great job. And I always tell our outfielders, you know, even coaching, take your step back. You can always come in on balls, but you see these youths always want to come in on something. First thing is always take that first step back, and he was able to do that, and that's some of the reasons why he was so good in the outfield.
Yeah, definitely. And another one of those moments too that ends up being real big, but because of all of the highlights of this game, is something that I think goes overlooked. So we move on to the bottom of the seventh. Kurt Schilling is, you know, cut, I don't know if you'd call it escaping a jam, but getting out of that inning, and he's due up at the bottom of the seventh. I think a lot of people are wondering if he's going to hit, and sure enough, he does. He does hit leadoff in the bottom of the seventh, and this was a moment, Patrick, where Tim McCarver's questioning the decision that Bob Brenly's making due to the home run power on Brenly's bench. He quotes a stat about some of the power that he's got, home run power on that bench, and I'm sure a lot of fans in Arizona, you know, despite the dominance that he had shown throughout the year, throughout the series, and even in the game, were probably thinking the same thing that McCarver was thinking.
Yeah, this is crazy.
They had Madrick Cummings on the bench. Come on.
Crazy decision to make. And unless it was, I mean, I need to make sure. They have Reggie Sanders on the bench.
Yes.
Unless, yeah, right? 33 yeah. Home runs, Reggie Sanders. Like, and listen, even if it is Madrick Cummings, you guys saw Kurt Schilling's at bats.
Yeah.
Kurt Schilling's at bats are terrible. Like, you're not, it's not like you're hoping, like, it's not like you have a decent hitting pitcher. You know, maybe a ball finds a hole. Kurt Schilling was not putting the ball in play. Kurt Schilling wasn't touching the ball.
Yep.
And in a game that's this low scoring with this high of stakes, like, you really want to send him, like, you, I get he's Brenly's gun shy because of the bullpen, obviously, for sure. But do you really want to take that risk that, like, you're just forfeiting it at bat? I don't know. I totally agree with
you. Gave up the out. He gave up the out for the pitcher. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, his it thing was, I need three outs. He's only one out. He's going to get me three outs on the other side.
Yeah, it's true.
And it was fun because we know how this game's going to end. But Jab, at this point, you know, the Fox broadcast is showing Randy Johnson, who was still on the D-backs bench at this point.
Those jackets are amazing.
Oh, I love it. The uniforms are great too, man.
That's so good.
Again, talking about things that make it seem like it's an old game. Those uniforms, whew, they didn't age well.
Oh. I love those uniforms.
So
I do
good.
Too, but they look old. They look old. But speculation's beginning. You know, are we going to see Randy Johnson? Is he going to appear? He's still on the bench at this point.
And he's on the bench. He's not even in the bully, right? Wasn't he on the bench?
He's on the bench. Yep. In the dugout.
Yeah, so he's not even in the bullpen, meaning, because nowadays you see it, like I was talking about earlier with Strauss and those guys, like Scherzer was in the bullpen for, you know, game seven, like everybody's all hands on deck type thing. They weren't even thinking about that. That was something we had talked about. But this was when those point where you're like, well, is Randy going to get up? Is, you know, we'll see if he gets in there. They didn't want it. Like Patrick said, they were so gun shy with that bullpen. The only guy that they trusted was Batista at that point, I think, in that bullpen, Miguel, right?
Yep. And he was a starter for half the year for them.
Yeah. Definitely. So that was fun, kind of knowing the outcome of this that made the drama there a little bit fun. Clemens gets Schilling strikeout looking. Tony Womack's up next. He singles to right field. It's a ground ball between the first and second baseman. And that's going to do it for Roger Clemens. So Mike Stanton comes in. My guy, Mike Stanton, comes in to replace Clemens. And he faces Craig Counsell. Womack gets caught stealing, and Stanton, Patrick, is just, you know, he's a lefty, just repeatedly throwing over to first and keeping him on there tight. We start hearing in the broadcast about, you know, some of the struggles that Jorge Posada was having throwing guys out later in the year. But I think this is really a testament to the job that Stanton did holding him so closely. You know, ultimately it is a caught stealing and Posada gets the job done, but maybe not the best jump from Womack there.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if he gets any sort of jump, Womack was so fast that he, I mean, that's what he was at the top of that lineup for specifically. But yeah, I mean, it's the Yankees, that Yankees bullpen, and I can still remember the names. It was like Stanton, Graham Lloyd, Jeff Nelson, Ramiro Mendoza, all those guys. And it was all throughout the years, but Stanton was the one constant of the, that guy was always a Yankee. I think eventually he came over to the Mets, but I'll remember him. Everybody remembers him as a Yankee, and he was a lefty killer. And to be a reliever that's that, not only, I mean, that has a good enough pickoff move to keep Womack honest is something that's kind of underrated too.
And he was quick to the plate too. He did a really good job of, you know, not sitting up there like Fernando Valenzuela with a, with that right front leg up for a while. You know what I mean? And if you read it, you could go. He was quick to the plate, even though he was keeping you close there. The other thing that I found interesting, every time we keep saying Craig Counsell, I know I'm old, but now I feel like you guys are getting to that point where now Craig Counsell's been in the league as a manager for like 5 years.
I know. I know. It's weird.
It is really weird. Yeah.
I mean, he looked like a baby in this series.
Yeah, he did. Well, so many things about that. All of Derek Jeter's hair made me feel old because we saw Jeter with no hair for so long. There's a lot of things about this that make me feel old. After that moment, by the way, when there's two outs, we see a Fox graphic here that says the last two Game 7 World Series games have gone extra innings. So I think people are starting to have that in their mind as to, you know, whether this game's going to head to extras. Stanton ends up getting Counsell to pop. It's a foul pop fly to the first baseman to end that inning. And then up come the Yankees in the top of the eighth. Schilling still on the mound. But this is when things really start to turn for the Yankees. So top of the eighth, Schilling's return to the mound. Randy Johnson is in the bullpen now. He's warming up. But the Yankees jump out to a 2-0 lead when leadoff hitter Alfonso Soriano hits an 0-2 pitch out of the park. And Patrick, Soriano had really a heck of a series. Hit a walk-off single in the bottom of the 12th in Game 5. A young guy at this point in his baseball career and a huge moment for him here in Game 7.
He was Robinson Cano before Robinson Cano. He was that next Yankee star. That this postseason was the moment that, like, you kind of realize, like, oh my god, they have another. Like, it just seemed like the Yankees pipeline was never ending, because by that point Bernie Williams and Jeter are well established. Like, those are great players. And Soriano in this World Series is 25 years old. It's his first full season. I mean, he had an okay regular season, but you're right, couple big moments. And this particular home run off Schilling on an 0-2 pitch that is at his ankles. I mean, almost at his feet. Like, he has no business hitting that ball where he hit it. Just proves how crazy talented. It was kind of like a portent of, like, how good Soriano was going to be, because the next year, 200 hits, 39 home runs, 41 steals. Like, he practically went 40-40. He did later in his career with the Nats. A phenomenal player, and it's just, this is the moment where you saw the replay of that pitch and it amazed me. I just remember thinking, like, how does a guy hit that pitch out? And I can't imagine Curt Schilling felt any different.
And also, if you think about it, remember that time too, as much as you hated the Yankees, you felt at that time, if you know how ESPN puts those things up and they say a percentage that they're going to win this game, knowing the Yankees, knowing the time, knowing the emotion that's tied in with this, knowing with where they're at and knowing who the hammer they have in the back end of that bullpen, there's no chance that ESPN had it any lower than probably about 95% that the Yankees were going to win this game.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
So it's 2-1 Yankees after the Soriano home run. Schilling's still in. He gets Scott Brosius to strike out swinging. David Justice will then pinch hit for Mike Stanton for the Yankees. And Justice singles to center field, and that is going to do it for Curt Schilling. And what a neat moment in this broadcast. You see Arizona skipper Bob Brenly come out to remove Schilling, clearly frustrated that he's leaving the game down 2-1. After a commercial break, they come back, and you can hear the audio of what Brenly is telling Schilling, and he tells him, love you, brother. You're my hero. That ain't going to beat us. We're going to get that back and then some. Really cool, awesome moment in this broadcast, Patrick, something that I really, really enjoyed hearing, and just kind of made what happens next even more special.
Yeah, and it kind of goes in line with what Brenly has kind of always been characterized as, and that's as a player's manager. Like, that's why he was brought in. He was brought in, I think, right after, was he brought in right after Buck in Arizona?
He was. Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yep.
And at that time,
Buck built the team, and then Buck was a disciplinarian
at that point. And like Buck obviously softened once he got to Baltimore, but Buck had his rules and how he wanted to do things, and they kind of swung back totally in the other direction with Brenly, who had not previously been a big league manager, I don't believe, and was just a really well-liked guy in the clubhouse. And seeing that kind of moment on the mound is kind of makes you realize why they hired that guy. Yeah. And maybe not the greatest strategist ever, especially when it came to the hitting Schilling in the seventh. But it kind of comes back and like these guys like him, these guys trust him, and having a conversation like that on the mound with your pitcher, you know that's not the first time he's kind of expressed those emotions to Schilling.
Yeah, Brenly was the announcer. I'm pretty sure he came out of the booth. I think he was an announcer for them, right? Yeah.
Yep, right out of the booth. Yeah, pretty wild. Pretty wild story.
It's like Fred Manfred coming down, Zach, and helping out the birds.
That's right. So Miguel Batista relieved Schilling, who got Derek Jeter ground into a force out. And then Brenly turns to Randy Johnson, who was game six's starter. And Johnson gets Chuck Knobloch to fly out to right field to finish the inning. So things were starting to look a little bleak for the Diamondbacks. Mariano Rivera coming out of the bullpen for a six-out save. He's facing the 3-4-5 hitters in Arizona's lineup. It's looking like this is their best chance to get something going, but of course it's against a future Hall of Fame closer. And what happens? So Rivera allows a single to Steve Finley, but he fans Luis Gonzalez, Matt Williams, and Danny Bautista to end their chances there in the bottom of the eighth inning. So
just dirty stuff too, Patrick. Just nasty. Cutters just cutting all
this
over
is
the place.
It's peak Mariano. It's something you will never see again. And it's like there you can say that about a couple things in baseball, but Mariano truly was a guy who had he had a changeup, he had a two seam fastball, whatever, but it was a cutter. Yep. It was one pitch he threw like 90% of the time. And nobody could touch it. And he was game over in the postseason. Like there were no blemishes on his postseason resume. I think he had a 0.64 ERA coming into this game. And, some of that came from when he was the setup man for John Wetland. Yep. When they were, the late 90s Yankees. But once he was the closer, he was untouchable. There was, I think in New York, the Yankees, had him on the mound with the bases loaded and one out, and he wriggled out of that too. And he was you just knew it was over. When you saw him coming in, you knew it was over. And that's what it felt like.
Yeah, you could feel the emotion in the stands too. Obviously, the hometown crowd feeling really deflated with their 3-4-5 hitters up and really nothing to show for it but that single from Steve Finley. So they move on to the top of the ninth. Randy Johnson back out in relief, and he's got to face the Yankees 3-4-5 hitters, and quite efficiently he does. Bernie Williams, Tino Martinez, Jorge Posada all down on just 12 pitches. So real dominance there, jab from Randy Johnson, who was out just a little bit earlier in game six. But keeping this a one-run game before some craziness ensues in the bottom of the ninth.
What I like about this, too, is the emotions that go back and forth. As soon as Johnson comes in, the crowd goes nuts again, right? Because they're down 2-0, but now Randy Johnson comes in, and so we got a shot. 3-4-5 hitters come up, and Rivera just completely silences them after the leadoff single. So you could see the emotion, kind of like a roller coaster, just going up and down for these fans, sitting on their hands, going up, back and forth, and then Randy comes in there and does his work, and his job was to make sure that you go out there and you just do your job. You're going to probably have to throw, I don't know if Brenly had a pitch count in his mind, but he knew that this guy was throwing so many strikes. Pitching, the day before is not going to really water as long as you can get two innings from this guy. Because I don't think he would have came out for a third, Patrick, if they went to extra innings. But for that time, Randy Johnson knew that he could come back and fire, and he did, and he got them where they needed to be.
Yeah, I don't know what would have happened if they went to extras. I mean, where else do you go?
They already used Bautista. Yeah, they already used Bautista.
Brenly's playing for a 9-inning game, and I think he had said prior to the game that if they were facing lefties, he'd think about using somebody else. But if it wasn't a lefty heavy lineup, he said he was gonna go to BK, Byung-hyun Kim, which would have been the reaction Byung-hyun Kim would have gotten in Arizona would have been very interesting, because I'm sure the default response of most fans would have been to boo him. But do you really want to crush the guy's confidence who's trying to close out Game 7 of the World Series for you. I would have. It's something we were deprived of.
That's true. About the only thing we were deprived of in this game. That's true. All right, so on to the bottom of the ninth. Rivera still on the bump, and the bottom of the order due up for the Diamondbacks. So Mark Grace starts things off. It's a single to center.
Three hits.
Yeah.
He went 3-for-4 in this game,
solid
by the way.
Game.
Another great player.
San Diego State, baby.
So he singles to center. It's on a 1-0 pitch. And then David DeLucci comes in to pinch run. Next batter is Damian Miller. This is like the definition of small ball jabby is what happens here. So Damian Miller lays down a bunt. Rivera tosses to Jeter, who's covering at second, and is unable to make the catch cleanly. Some of that's due to a hard slide from DeLucci, who's trying to break up a double play, but the throw is definitely off from Rivera jab. And Jeter stays down here. We talked about him kind of being banged up in this game. He stays down for a bit. Trainers rush out to check on him. Ultimately, it ends up being an E1, and it's first and second with no outs.
I kind of think you're definitely having a replay on this whole deal, right? I mean, if this was in, you know, modern times, we would definitely have some type of relay there, or replay. There would have been some interesting deal. They wouldn't have Joe Torre on the actual he couldn't do the rules anymore because he's actually in the dugout. But knowing the Yankees, Patrick, they probably had someone else ready to go to take care of this. But, yeah, you're right. I don't know if the slide would have been legal, but I'll tell you, that was the baseball that I grew up watching. And you know, I thought it was, I mean, that's what you're doing. And like you said, it's so great. They're at the bottom of the lineup. You get my boy Gracie up there. He gets a base hit. They bring in DeLucci, which is just all these names are just so great to think about.
It's crazy.
And your boy Damian Miller comes up and lays down a great bunt. And, you know, that's the way they had to do it. And it is small ball, man. They were getting as small as you could get.
So, Patrick, you know, reading about what was happening in this game, I saw a lot about a hard slide and, you know, some talk about whether this would be legal today. Rewatching it, to me, it didn't seem like this was as hard as what I was reading in game recaps. I don't know that this would have been illegal today. What do you think?
My definition of a hard slide is Chase Utley trying to murder Ruben Tejada. And honestly, I thought it was totally within reason for the play. Like, I don't think DeLucci went out of his way to try and, you know, just take out Jeter. It was trying to break up a double play. And part of it, too, is that throw is up the line towards first base.
Right.
And it takes that throw takes Jeter into the slide. So it makes it look worse, I think, than it actually is because of the throw. And when you see that throw, it's kind of like I started believing that something different was going to happen when that,
you're
when
hoping.
That happened. I was starting to wonder, this doesn't look like it always looks. Like, Mariano Rivera never makes mistakes. That throw was definitely off target, and you started thinking of things. Like, I didn't actually believe it could happen, but seeing the runners on base, I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
Can you imagine, Jab, what Twitter would have been like in this moment?
Oh, my God. I can, because I'm on it occasionally, but yes, it would have been crazy. And at the time, I'm just trying to think too. I know, Patrick, you were rooting against the Yankees because you hated the Yankees, and I mean I had just got to Baltimore, so I didn't really have like a, you know, one way or another in regards to, I just thought I wanted to see a cool series. And, you know, you just, baseball is just great and whenever it's played in New York. But don't you think most of the country, because of where we were, because of New York, because of everything with September 11th, we're kind of rooting for the Yankees in this one because it's Arizona too?
I wonder that, because I, like I said, when it was in New York and they had those awesome home runs, I'm like, oh man, this is a great moment for the city, great moment for a lot of people, et cetera, et cetera. By game 7, when it got to here, I was rooting for the Diamondbacks.
Yeah.
I was. And the thing is, it's just, I was so sick and tired of seeing the Yankees win all the time.
Yep.
Especially, I mean, listen, I'm a Mets fan, so obviously it's closer to me than anything. They just beat the Mets the year prior. But I think any baseball fan, AL East baseball fans, any of the teams they had beaten in the World Series, the Braves, the Padres, any of the teams they had beaten, people were tired of seeing the Yankees win. I was. Anybody that wasn't a Yankees fan, I think, even though they, like, yes, you want to see the city of New York heal, obviously, for sure, but you're just tired of seeing, like, man, the Yankees are going to win four World Series in a row, really? Like, and it just seems like it was never going to end. And Yankees fans were less than gracious about winning three World Series in a row.
Well put. Yeah, it's interesting. The three of us, you know, two fans of a team in the AL East and one a Mets fan, because maybe we're a little biased in this, but I know we were all rooting against the Yankees in this series. So I'd be curious, you know, if you're a fan of another team, what you were thinking in this moment, whether you were tired of watching the Yankees win or whether you were kind of rallying around them at this point. So you'll have to let us know. I'd love to hear from some folks about that.
Thank God Twitter wasn't around then.
All right, so Randy Johnson's up at this point. Jay Bell is going to pinch hit for him. He, too, is going to put down a bunt. And Rivera, who, you know, looked shaken the last time, he's going to toss to third, get out the lead runner for out number one. He tosses to third baseman Scott Brosius, who holds on to the ball instead of firing to first for a double play attempt. This was another thing that I read in the recap and then watching, didn't think it was as close to being a double play as the recap made it out to be, Patrick. I don't know that Brosius could have fired to get two here. I think holding on to that ball and getting the lead runner was the right move.
I totally agree. I think it's people, when you slow it down on replay, people all of a sudden think like, oh, I mean, he would have had him by like two steps. Yeah, what if he overthrows that ball? Like, honestly, it's not like he had time to gather himself, you know, make an easy throw over to first. He would have needed to make, it would have been a great play. I mean, it would have been a heads up play and it would have been a quick reaction play. And you're taking the risk of that throw from third to first. I've seen something like this happen where the Mets lost the World Series on a weird throw from David Wright, and then Lucas Duda, all he needed to do was throw home, and he chucked it away. Weird things happen, and they had just seen it happen with Rivera. Weird things happen in pressure games when the ball is in play. Just take
the other
it out
thing too is Brosius didn't have the best arm. He didn't have like a Machado type cannon over there either. And he was a smart player. Remember, that guy won the World Series MVP in 1998. So he'd been around. I mean, he'd been in these spots. I'm going to trust a guy who's been in these spots to hold the ball, as we like to say in the coaching ranks, eat it and go ahead and just, you know, play for another play, as opposed to making it a bigger inning, especially in that kind of tight and how tight that game was.
Yeah, that's a good point, Jeb. Definitely. And I'm with you there, Patrick, too. Weird things can happen. And if I'm him, get the lead runner. And you know, turn things back over to Mariano Rivera. No reason to question Mariano Rivera.
Yeah.
Medrick Cummings comes in. He's going to pinch run for Damian Miller at second base. Then Tony Womack steps up. He smacks a 2-2 pitch down the right field line. He's going to score Cummings, tie the game at two with the winning run on third base. Jabby Burns, the place goes berserk.
Tony Womack had a fantastic series. He had a fantastic at bat. He fouled off a lot of tough pitches in that at-bat too, Patrick. And for him to be able to kind of – basically, it was another cutter that just didn't cut. I mean, it was probably one of 50 that didn't cut, actually. And he was able to get a little bit of a barrel on there and to be able to get into right field. And I just love the fact that we've brought up Medrick Cummings twice on this podcast so far, Patrick.
I remember this specific hit probably more than I remember the actual end of the game. I remember going nuts when this happened in my living room with my parents, because everything else, like, yeah, it was like you said, Zach, it was small ball. It was a single up the middle by Grace. It was the ball gets thrown away. Nobody had hit Rivera hard yet. And eventually, like, it's so tough to string together so many kind of like balls that find holes. And Womack smoked this ball. I mean, absolutely just kind of opened himself up a little bit, sat on the cutter, and just opened up his shoulders and crushed one into right field. And that's kind of when you knew, like, okay, this never happens. Like, occasionally, yeah, like some weird things happen, you know, the ball gets thrown away or whatever. This ball was so rare to see balls off Mariano Rivera that were hit hard. And this ball was hit really hard into the corner. And you could tell at that point that he wasn't himself.
Yeah, and this is why in being a sports fan for my entire life and being somebody who loves analytics, I just have a hard time with dismissing momentum, because I feel like I'm watching momentum unfold here in this game, you know? And maybe there's an analytical way to describe what's happening. And again, I love the stats. I do. I think they have done so much for baseball. But you're just watching it build in this moment. And I think you said it perfectly, Patrick, in leading to what happens next. So infield's drawn in, the infield and outfield drawn in. Rivera is facing Craig Counsell. He hits him with an 0-1 pitch. Now it's bases loaded, one out. Luis Gonzalez at the plate. So Gonzalez, he was 0-4 heading into this at-bat. He hits a soft liner over the head of Derek Jeter, who jumps up to try to snag it, but no use. That's going to bring in Bell, and he seals the walk-off victory for the Diamondbacks. Few things about this before I get both of your guys' takes. Joe Buck's call was amazing on this. I know people have their opinions of Joe Buck. Personally, I'm a fan. But he described the play, let the crowd noise take over. His call was, floater, center field, the Diamondbacks are world champions. And then it's just crowd noise. And I thought that was just the perfect way to call this walk-up. Amazing. Gonzalez said after the game, he said, this will probably go down as one of the best World Series ever. And then one of my favorite moments was seeing Schilling, who obviously came out down 2-1. He's the first one out of the dugout, races over to Gonzalez, who's between first and second, and is the first one to embrace him and hug the hero. So what say you, Patrick? Where do you want to start with the crazy walk-off?
I want to start, and there are people who don't like Joe Buck. I disagree with him. I think Buck, for the most part, is very good. There were a couple of years there where he lost his voice, which was totally not his fault, but I think he has some great calls. I want to focus on the other guy in the booth. Tim McCarver called this, literally called exactly what happened, the pitch, like literally 10 seconds before the pitch. If you listen to the broadcast, they're talking about the infield being drawn in, and Tim McCarver says, I think almost to a T, the issue with this is that when Rivera's facing lefties, you get a lot of soft hits, a lot of broken bat hits. So something can float into the shallow outfield for a hit. And literally 15 seconds later, Luis Gonzalez does what he does. It is, and I remember being a kid, I remember being a teenager and being like, oh, Tim McCarver again. Do we really need to have Tim McCarver in the booth? This is Tim McCarver. If he wants to go back, he can point to this and say, this is why I'm in the booth. Moments like this, calling that perfectly, is why he's in the booth.
Yeah, and he was good too. And that's a great point, because everybody, you know, I thought Buck did a great job too of letting it kind of just flow and letting it, you know, you don't have to step all over that. That's a fantastic moment. And those guys kind of built for that too, right? It's kind of tough. You know, I think Costas always talks about that, like trying to figure out what to do when those big moments happen. The big thing for me that I noticed in this thing is how big the lipper that Schilling had as soon as he got out of the game. Holy cow. He put in a big old dipper in there. And so the whole game, they keep showing him, and it's just flying all over his lip the whole time on the bench. Because remember, they did so many cutaways to Schilling and to Randy, more than they did to even Brenly and the rest of the guys. You know what I mean? It felt like they were everything was on their shoulders one way or another. But when Gonzalez got the base hit, go up the middle again, I'm pretty sure that bat has so many, breaks in it from that swing too, because there's no chance he got anything. But on that thing was right on the trademark to get that thing over into center field to bleed it. Basically, there's blood all over that bat, and to see that jump, that emotion from everybody, I thought that was just fantastic. And like you said, it was a World Series. It was a time in our life, Zach, where we really, really needed something like that. Whether the Yankees won or not, it's almost kind of great that they didn't, but they were part of one of the better World Series that we've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. And the story, Arizona becoming World Series champions, just their fourth year in existence as an expansion team, ending the Yankees' bid at four consecutive World Series titles as abruptly as you possibly could. And this one, Schilling and Randy Johnson were named World Series MVPs. Just kind of focusing on the expansion team aspect of this, they're the first expansion team to win a championship this fast. And, you know, I know we recently had, 2018, when they played the Caps, the Vegas Golden Knights making it to the NHL finals. But this was a really huge moment in sports history to see a team like this jump out and become a champion. And it was the first championship for the state of Arizona. So just a huge, huge moment.
Yeah, I like also that you talked about how they kept the Yankees lineup to 183 average. I mean, just think about those Hall of Famers that are in that lineup, and to be able to have that, Everybody in the lineup, they just couldn't hit. No one got good. You talk about how hard it was for everybody to barrel up to barrel up Rivera. Think about what these Yankees hitters had to do to try to barrel up Johnson and Schilling.
Yeah, and it's the thing with this Arizona team, too, is it's, if you look at that roster, this is an old team. And I think we've talked about, you know, possibly how many fans of other teams are rooting for the Yankees. I think there's so many guys on this team. Like, for example, if you're a Cubs fan, you're telling me you don't want to see Mark Grace, 37-year-old Mark Grace, win a World Series. Same with 35-year-old Matt Williams.
Who's Mike Morgan.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, if you're a Mariners fan, Randy Johnson is 37 at this point, which is crazy because he kept pitching after this.
Your boy Reggie Sanders.
Reggie Sanders, exactly. Like, this is an older team, so it's always great to see any team win a World Series, but seeing so many guys who had been around the league for so long on so many teams who had been either snake bitten or just hadn't gotten there to win the World Series, that on the field celebration was great.
Yep, amazing.
Do you want to get real old here, guys? Bobby Witt Jr. was just drafted this past year, correct? His dad played in this World Series. Now, he was only in for one game and probably pitched to one batter. Maybe got an inning, but still, Bobby Witt. That's how old we are, brother.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. Well, that's game 7 of the 2001 World Series. Jab, where were you?
I was in our apartment in Baltimore. My wife now, Trisha, had let me stay with her during when I was courting her, when I stalked her from San Diego and moved out here in September 2000. So I was here. I was working for the Orioles. And so September 11th happened. We all know what happened there. I was actually in the warehouse when that happened. We all just kind of went home and went over, tried to figure out this crazy times, kind of like what we're in now, but just a different deal. And I was just sitting watching it on the smallest television because my wife's not a big sports, or she wasn't until she met me, but wasn't the biggest sports fan, but I had to have this game on. So she had this, like, I'm talking, Zach, one of those TVs that you got in the dorm rooms back in the early 2000, 2001, where you thought you were a big baller. It was the smallest TV, and I was laying in bed watching it, and I'll never forget it. It was such a great moment, and went back to the moments that you have as a kid watching. You know, I watched the Maguire thing with my dad. I watched Cal breaking that 21-31 day. You know, those are some of moments you remember where you were at. I remember exactly where I was at. I was laying on the bed. It was an amazing game from a baseball perspective. But I love doing this because the nuances of the game itself and the series, because I watched a couple of the games from this series, Patrick, is what thing I really, really started to kind of get out of it. And as I've grown as a coach and grown as a individual baseball wise, it's some of those small things that made this series so spectacular.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, I remember exactly where I was in Womack at that double. And obviously, I was in the same place when Gonzalez walked it off with the single. You're right. It was, I mean, this was taking away. I mean, obviously, the whole 9/11 situation made this having sports back even more special, obviously. But the dramatics of this series with the Yankees walk-offs and Derek Jeter becoming Mr. November and so many great, great moments that led to a great Game 7. And it's, sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes you don't get a great Game 7 after a great series. But this really lived up to the billing of one of the most dramatic and fun sporting events that I can remember.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think it gave a lot of hope to baseball fans, right? Seeing an expansion team come in and in 4 years winning a championship. I know as a sports fan, it's funny to think about this because watching the Yankees be so dominant kind of almost turned me away from baseball at this point, right? And I sort of later on in life had a similar feeling with the NFL and with the Patriots dominance. I know some people really love these big bad teams that reel off championships, and it's, you know, I was 13 years old when this happened and was in my late 20s and early 30s when the Patriots were as dominant as they were. And it turns me off, right? But having a moment like this where, it gives hope to some other fan bases is really big. This one is especially interesting, too. You know, we all remember 9/11. And we all remember the impact. We all remember Bush's first pitch. And having those two moments kind of tied together. And, you know, Jab, we talk a lot about what sports does to kind of heal some of the pain that we're feeling from other things that much needed distraction. You couldn't find a more perfect example of it here.
No, it was, and it's funny that we're doing this now in the time that we're in now too, because we're all just dying for small things, and you know, we're watching documentaries and we're watching, you know, drafts and all these different things. But that was really, really brought everybody together, and baseball will do that for you every single time.
No doubt. So this game was unique because we had two MVPs. This series was unique because we had two MVPs. But regardless, after recapping each game or series or whatever, we're going to give our three stars of the game. We haven't talked about this before doing this show. Do we have any discrepancy between my three stars and your three stars? Is there anybody else that you guys
there's
would like
one.
To add?
Okay.
I think there's one spot that can be debated, because I don't think you can debate Schilling or Johnson.
No.
All right. Well, let's just reel them off then. So Schilling and Johnson, the two MVPs. Schilling stats: 3 starts, 21 1/3 innings, 12 hits, 4 earned runs, 2 walks, 26 strikeouts for a 2.98 ERA. Randy Johnson pitched in 3 games. He had 2 starts and obviously appeared in game 7. 17 1/3 innings, 9 hits. 2 earned runs, 3 walks, 19 Ks for a 2.49 ERA. I put Danny Bautista as my third star here. 5 games, 7 for 12 with a run, a pair of doubles, 7 RBI, a walk, and a strikeout. His slash line was 583, 615, 750. So let's go to Patrick here if we've got some discrepancies there with Bautista.
Well, when you're given Batista's series line, is this for the series or is this for the game?
Well, I was given his series because I feel like we're kind of naming the MVP. So, but I don't know. If you could take it however you want to take it, Patrick. If you want to give it for the game, take it for the game.
I want to take it for the game. I have to throw Womack in there, man. That moment when he hit that double was just like, it's like seeing Superman get knocked out. Like it just didn't compute. It didn't make sense. Like seeing him hit, like a guy who's not Luis Gonzalez, who's not one of the big boppers in their lineup, to hit a ball that hard off Rivera is just jarring. And it really kind of made you realize, like, this is different. Something different is happening now. There's no more bunting. There's no more lucky hits. And eventually, obviously, they won the game on a bleeder. But seeing him hit that ball off Rivera made you realize that, like, Rivera might not have it tonight, and this might not be going the same way that the, you know, 4 of the last 5 World Series did.
Yeah, maybe Rivera wasn't Thanos after all. You like that, Zach? You see what I did there? Thanos? Zach, my guy would have been Steve Finley. He hit 368 in the series, and if you remember, like we talked about earlier, he doesn't come up with that big catch that could have been a much bigger deficit, and this whole thing would have been all for naught, and the Yankees would be winning another World Series. So I would have given it to Steve Finley, but I'm so glad my boy Patrick, because we're always on the same wavelength, got my boy Tony Womack in there, because he was fantastic.
I love it. Very cool. All right, guys. Well, I have to tell you, I had a great time.
Oh yeah,
revisiting the fall, or I guess early winter of 2001. I don't know when winter starts, but this was the latest a World Series had ever started. So, we're going to travel back in time again next week, Jabby Burns. Where are we headed?
I think we're going to head back to the year 2000. Okay, we're really getting back in that DeLorean, as we like to say, Zach, and going 1 year back from this one. And this Super Bowl number 34, Walter Payton, if you will, Rams Titans. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but let's just say it was very tight at the end, Zach.
Yes. Yes, it was. Yeah, that's going to be a good one. It'll be fun to dive into. Really memorable Super Bowl.
Little Baltimore ties there, too, with the quarterback at the time for the Titans.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll
R.I.P.
We will definitely discuss that. So, well, I can't wait for that. That's going to be awesome. So, looking forward to it. Well, Jabby Burns, this was so much fun. It was great getting your insights on this game, and I can't wait to do it again next week and talk a little football.
Having a blast, Zach. Thanks for getting it back, and I promise I won't talk about a warm bath with you guys any longer.
Is that all right with you, Patrick Guthrie?
Yeah, cold showers from now on.
Well, it's good to talk to you too, man. This was fun. You had a lot of really good insights, and even after rewatching this, managed to find some things that you dug out that I missed. So always good talking to you, man.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Good to be here. Good to talk to you guys again. I'm looking forward to doing it the next couple of weeks.
Thanks for listening to Retro Sports Rewind. If you liked this week's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please rate and review the show. Our intro music is Proto Funk by Kevin MacLeod. Mid-show stinger is Scarlet Fire by Otis McDonald. And the outro music that you're listening to right now is District 4 by Kevin MacLeod. Links to the music can be found in our show notes. That's it for this week. We'll see you next week in the Georgia Dome for Super Bowl 34.